That was all. Curses, I grumbled, glaring at the less than satisfactory message before me. The only words that made any sense were clock and, at the end, unless, misspelled. Unless? Unless what? The words suggested altercation. Do such and so unless you want a thrashing, or won't do such and so unless... Unless what? A sentence ought not to end with unless. Unless the word were not misspelled but incomplete, the message had been interrupted, suggesting duress? I felt in my bones that I had hit upon the truth. Lady Cecily had been unable to finish her message. Evidently she was closely watched. I wished she had simply written in plain English, for she could have managed that more quickly. But then I realized why she had not done so. Invisible ink, although it dries clear, is not actually impossible to see. It leaves a sheen noticeable in certain lights. Handwriting might have been detected, but the straight-lined cipher had concealed itself nicely along the folds of the fan, looking like a sort of decoration, while being simple for a recipient to solve. Clever. And desperate. A cipher secretly written in invisible ink on a paper fan, of all things, then slipped to someone she met by accident, someone she barely knew. Certainly such a cipher ought to be a plea for assistance, for rescue, for help. Of course. The first four letters were not HELK. They were HELP. The cipher for P looked just like the cipher for C, except that it included a dot, which evidently I had not perceived. What of clock, then? Eureka! The next word had to be locked. Feverishly addressing my pencil to the cipher again, mindful of missing dots, I eventually arrived at the following. Help locked in, room starved, unless... I must admit that my first reaction upon reading this was one of immense gratification. I felt all of the thrill of the chase, and of elucidation. Eureka! I understood why Lady Cecily had worn such a silly thing as a bell skirt. She had been forced to do so in order to hobble her so that she could not possibly run away from her dragonish chaperones. Now, with her errands completed, she was, presumably, locked away again. But where? Here was a case of a missing person, indeed. I anticipated search, adventure, perhaps even a rescue. But immediately my fervour turned to horror for Cecily's sake. Could I find her in time? Could I find her before... What? She was being locked up and starved, unless... What? Unless she yielded to some demand, obviously. Unless she obeyed some command she had so far defied. Unless she agreed to... Oh, no, I whispered as I remembered. Oh, how awful! Could it be... A trousseau you will need, and a trousseau you shall have, one of the guardian dowagers had said. I had no very clear idea what a trousseau looked like, or what might be included in one. To the best of my knowledge, it consisted of expensive, lacy unmentionables. But I knew what a trousseau was for. They had brought her to London to shop for a trousseau. This meant that there was none prepared already. There had been no period of engagement, during which ribbons and ruffles might lovingly be stitched, and there was no time to order a supremely fashionable one from abroad. In my horror, I leapt to my feet, spilling paper, pencil, and writing desk to the floor. Lady Cecily was going to be married. Soon. And against her will. Chapter the Sixth. I had to find her, had to find Lady Cecily and rescue her from such a dreadful and unjust fate. But how? Enola, calm yourself. Think. That voice from within. It was as if my mother spoke to me, and for a moment Mum's face filled my mind. A comforting memory, but with it came a discomforting thought. I had been putting off the task of finding Mum. Why? Did I really not wish to see her? What sort of daughter was I? But then again, it was Mum who had first run away, not I. Yet hadn't I forgiven her? Blast everything! Confound questions I could not answer! No, did not wish to answer. Mentally thrusting them to the side, I sat down, picked up pencil and paper again, and told myself that, being in such dire straits, Lady Cecily came foremost. Then Mum. Then, a distant third, the Army General's leg bone, which, after all, he no longer needed for any practical purpose. Regarding Lady Cecily, what concerning her difficulty did I know, surely? Next to nothing. Very well, what could I surmise? I wrote, "Her mother is in seclusion. I cannot imagine Lady Theodora favouring forced marriage. Lady Cecily has been taken away from her mother. Probably Sir Eustace's idea." Which made sense. What to do with an unconventional, politically opinionated, distressingly left-handed daughter who has been scandalously kidnapped and will therefore be considered spoilt goods upon the marriage market? Why, bypass the usual coming out by arranging some private disposal of the girl, probably by financial inducement. It appeared that the two dragons with whom I had seen Cecily had charge of her for the time being. My task was now to identify and locate them. I wrote, "Her chaperones, proud and richly clothed, seemed to be of noble blood. The chaperones seemed to wield familial authority over her. They dressed her in greenish-yellow. Might they be of aesthetic taste? Cecily and her entourage took a cab, but the cab's number is not known. She most likely got the fan attending a pink tea. The Viscountess of Inglethorpe's pink tea?" All in all, not very helpful. Although I could not remember the number of the cab, still, I decided, I could be moderately proud of myself for having remembered the name of the Viscountess. Indeed, it was my only clue. If any of the society papers might, perhaps, have run a little piece about her pink tea party, and, supposing that the chaperones had attended along with Lady Cecily, if I could find an account that listed the names of the guests... But as my eyes turned towards the pile of rubbish I would have to read, I groaned aloud. Even if I found what I was looking for, then it would be necessary for me somehow to sort through the guests in order to find Lady Cecily's ogresses in waiting. Or, even worse, what if I scanned the confounded papers for hours and hours, and after all, the Viscountess's blasted tea party were not even there? A viscountess was not, after all, the social equal of a duke's wife, or even an earl's. What if no society reporter had bothered to— An idea caught hold with such force that my breath snagged in my throat. I let it stay there for a moment as I considered. Then, breathing out, I smiled. While I had no actual knowledge of what a society reporter might be like, I could imagine a female with more education than means, a genteel miss rather like a governess, obliged to make a living until she found a man to take care of her. Her clothing might be plain, even thread-worn, but never lacking in taste, an object of kindness and condescension. In great haste I began to hunt up my very proper, all-purpose brown tweed suit. Because I had skipped luncheon, there would still be time today. An hour or so later, in the aforementioned well-worn suit, neatly gloved, and hiding beneath a brown hat's veil, with a stenographer's notebook and a bundle of pencils in hand, I presented myself at the door of the Viscount of Inglethorpe's city residence. To the oversized tin soldier of a butler who eventually answered my knock, I said, "I am from the Woman's Gazette." I had checked many back issues of this much-admired publication, found no mention of anything Inglethorpe, and felt myself to be treading on fairly safe ground as I went on. "They have sent me to see whether I might do a feature on the Viscountess's pink tea."
"A bit late, aren't you?" rumbled the butler. "That was over a week ago."
"When in doubt, say nothing." I replied only with a meek smile.
His brows drew together. "Don't you have a card?"
"I'm new," I improvised. "They haven't printed me one yet."
"Oh, so that's the way it is. They send out a novice a week late." I did not mind the resentment in his tone, for it showed that I had guessed rightly. The Viscountess of Inglethorpe quite wanted to be included in the society papers with the same frequency and scope as, for instance, a duchess. The Viscountess felt herself much neglected in the ladies' press, and her household naturally shared this sentiment. I repressed a smile, feeling sure now that I would be admitted. Such vanity could not turn me away. Indeed, even as the butler betook himself upstairs to consult with Lady Inglethorpe, already the housekeeper, an unexpectedly pleasant woman named Dawson, was showing me into the morning room where the tea had taken place.
"We've left it just so," she was saying, "except for the flowers, of course, until the room is needed for something else, for my lady took great pains over the effect and likes to admire it."
Admire was perhaps not the word I would have used, for I felt as if I had stepped into a cow's udder. Never before had I entertained any prejudice against the colour pink, but I began to loathe it in that moment, as I stood beneath pink-draped windows with pink lambrequins, tables swaddled in pink, walls. Recollecting my guise, and also in order to hide my face in case it showed a touch of nausea, I flipped open a notebook and began feverishly to take notes. Pink grosgrain ribbon swags on dado and pictures, pink net billowing down from the ceiling, pink Japanese lanterns dangling from pink crocheted strings.
"We served coconut cakes iced pink and white, and we put pink ices shaped like cupids and swans on the tables. Her ladyship wore a pink tea frock that come all the way from France, and our servants had pink caps and pink aprons made special for the occasion. Oh, with the pink candles and all, it was like a pink fairyland in here."
Clenching my teeth against any heartfelt retort, scribbling, I muttered, "Flowers? Oh,
they're most lovely masses of pink cabbage roses, and for the gentlemen's buttonholes, pinks, only they were white. The flowers might be any colour, but they are called pinks, you know."
"Yes, I see," I forced a smile.
"How witty. Her ladyship's idea. And for favours, there were pink paper fans for the ladies, and pink paper top hats for the gentlemen."
Hollowly, I responded, "How very amusing."
"Yes, great fun they had with them."
Finally, a chance at the information I wanted.
"And the guests were?" "Jacobs is gone to ask the Viscountess whether he might give a copy of the guest list to you. Shall we go see whether he has come down?"
"Please." I am sure my tone sounded a bit too fervid. Being in that room made me feel as if I had gorged upon sugar plums. I drew a deep and thankful breath as we walked back into the more normally embellished hallway of the mansion. But as we passed the drawing-room door, which stood open, I jolted to an abrupt halt, staring.
"Splendid, isn't it?"
the housekeeper remarked when she realized what had distracted my attention. At the far end of the formal room, in the place of honour over the mantel of the hearth, hung a large gold-framed oil portrait of a lady elegantly bestowed upon a fainting sofa, a head-to-toe and nearly life-sized rendition of her carelessly holding a white Persian cat upon the most elaborate crimson-figured silk gown I had ever imagined or seen. Let me remark, as an aside, that the idea of keeping a house cat in a mansion full of expensive china has always struck me as absurd. But it seems that the richer one is, the more one must show off such idiotic behaviour as endangering one's Waterford crystal, or clutching to one's bosom a creature guaranteed to rub white fur all over one's sable ruche. However, it was not any of these considerations, nor yet the remarkably in-full-fig costume of the woman in the portrait, that stopped my steps. Rather, it was the dainty features of her fleshy face.
"That's my mistress, of course," the housekeeper was saying.
The Viscountess, one of the matrons whom I had seen in the ladies' lavatory. I had scarcely time to realize the peril in which I had placed myself before the butler's voice sounded behind me.
"Lady Otelia Thoroughfinch, Viscountess of Inglethorpe, wishes to see you in her private sitting-room."